Welcome back to Camera Conversations with your host, Colin Campbell. And today is episode 195 of the podcast, and I'm joined by Harrison Ward. Harrison is better known as the Fell Foodie and is an outdoor chef, public speaker, sobriety, and mental health advocate. You can expect to learn about how a lack of alignment and masking of your internal challenges can lead to a world of addiction and pain. Harrison speaks forthrightly about his alcoholism and challenges throughout his teens and early 20s, where his drinking was used to medicate himself from his own mind and challenges. I hugely appreciate Harrison's honesty and openness to describe this difficult period of his life, the emotional toll it took on himself and those around him, as he considered whether he even wanted to continue living. Importantly, Harrison made huge changes, and you'll get to hear about the steps he took to live the aligned, fulfilling, and purposeful life we see online today. The positive ripple effect of Harrison's own personal changes have also supported others through his content, his public speaking, and his encouragement to get outdoors and embrace nature. A recent theme in some of the episodes has been the importance of embracing the positive elements of our ancestry and the elements of life that were simpler in previous generations. It's important not to let the negative aspects of modern technology and how fast-paced life is nowadays corrupt us. And I certainly think there's lots to learn and strip back when we sometimes go back to basics and benefit from just getting outdoors, getting movement, and being more in touch with nature and our own ancestral heritage. Today's podcast is sponsored and supported by Clean Food Meal Prep. I, at the time of recording, have had one of the busiest two-week periods of my life. I've recorded five different podcasts. I've got all my training sessions in. I've been working in my 9 to 5. And I've still been trying to be hyper-social with a couple of big events and a few different birthday meals that I've been out for. But quite simply, I've refused to compromise on one of the most important things to me, and that is the food and the fuel I put in my body. Importantly, I've outsourced that area to Clean Foods Meal Prep, and it saved me over 120 minutes of cooking every single week. And the meals are much more varied and tasty than I could possibly make myself. While today's guest Harrison is very skilled indeed in the kitchen and, of course, even cooking outdoors, I certainly am not, and I benefit massively from outsourcing this area. And the meals are delivered every single Monday or Thursday to your door to keep you going throughout the week. They're macro tracked, they're calorie accounted for, and they're extremely healthy and nutritious. And I really, really believe you are what you eat, and the food that you put in your body is the fuel for your mind and your body. You can get a discount on your order for Clean Foods using the code CAMBRO, which will get you 15% off the link in the description. And while the meals are cooked in Glasgow, they are delivered across the UK, so no matter whether you're north or south, you can get those meals delivered to your door and get back some of that important time while still fueling yourself adequately. One thing to say before we dive into this podcast, I am so grateful for the continued support. The reaction to last week's episode with Ross Anderson and another powerful story on the lows and the highs that you can experience has been absolutely amazing. I'm very, very thankful for that. If you're new here, please make sure you've hit the subscribe or the follow button. And if you're really enjoying this episode, what you can do is hover your finger over and hit the 5-star rating button, or of course, pass this episode on to a friend or family member that you think would enjoy the episode as well. The music's going to play and you'll hear from myself and Mr. Harrison Ward. Harrison, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for making the trip to Glasgow. We get to do this in person.
Absolutely. No, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here. And thank you for raising the sunshine as well.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Well, you brought some north with you, and I made sure it stayed when you arrived, which is great. And we even got the sunshine for our walk around Glasgow's wonderful city centre this morning with a little coffee as well.
It's been grand, hasn't it? I mean, not used to this weather. Sort of, again, northern parts I'm in too, used to a lot of wetter weather, but yeah, it's nice when it's out, isn't it? See, it's full glory.
Yeah, and you're a man that's really enjoying the outdoors, come real rain or shine. And the Fell Foodie is the kind of name you go by nowadays. But I want to go back to way before the outdoor chef, the public speaker, the mental health advocate, and understand what it was like growing up as a young Harrison.
Well, I think nothing untoward, really. I don't think there's anything sort of to unearth in sort of the childhood, really. I think it was a pretty normal childhood. Grew up sort of in rural Cumbria, you know, nice house, good school, that sort of way. Plenty of friends, that sort of area. And yeah, sort of enjoyed the outdoors to a degree, being in sort of a rural setting, but wouldn't say I was particularly into any particular activities or team sports and stuff.
What about from a food perspective? Because nowadays, if people look at your kind of culinary expertise, they would be like, oh, I wonder how long he's been crafting that particular tool and into his 30s now and a bit of an expert in that space. Well, maybe you would play modest, but I would certainly say an expert compared to my skill set. But was there anything pointing towards that in your childhood?
Elements. I think I enjoyed the fact that food sort of brought people together. There were some good cooks in the family, especially the matriarchs as it was then. I spent a lot of time with my grandmother growing up. She was often looking after us. My mum was sort of a single parent nurse, working a lot of nights in the infirmary. So spent a lot of time at my gran's house that way. And she was always cooking everything, a typical sort of home cook. Everything was crafted from scratch and really enjoyed the process. And I guess I was the oldest of sort of seven cousins, so I wasn't allowed to just sit and ready for tea on the table sort of thing. It was often being put to work on there over the stove, whether it's peeling potatoes or just washing the pots. So you sort of got an avenue into there and sort of saw what was going on. But really enjoyed the fact that it was quiet. We'd often gather on a Sunday, the family would all come over, and enjoyed the fact that food had that connection with people. That's the bit I really identified with growing up. And of course, the flavours too. I like to try new things, see what was there and experiment and actually going through the process too. Maybe the sort of practical nature of it and the scientific blends of these recipes. So it definitely sparked something in those early days, those first days with my gran. But it was the start, I guess, of something more with food.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And we're probably going to talk quite a lot about what we've lost from our ancestors throughout this conversation in terms of in touch with the outdoors and stuff like that. But one of the things that spoke to me there was that whole sitting down as a family to eat is so rare mm-hmm. nowadays. And touch wood, growing up for myself, again, you and I are similar age, so maybe it's a more recent thing that's been lost, but we always had Sunday dinner and as much as possible, unless we had particular things on like a night in terms of sports or an activity or Cub Scouts or whatever it was, we would try and sit down with our, at the time, mum and dad and go through what we learned at school that day. And there was a connection around the meal as well. And maybe on a Friday it was fajitas, or on a Monday it was fish and chips, or on a Tuesday it was a pasta dish. So there was a relation between the food and almost checking in with each other as well.
I think so. It was a place to share, wasn't it? I think it was a place to catch up over. I think it was what was going on in your week. Again, perhaps, you know, maybe communication tools weren't quite the same as what they are now as well. So you often came together, I suppose, over that week, didn't you? And say, what have you been up to? How's work? Those bits which you weren't in daily contact all the time. So, and certainly looking more on sort of the continents or the European, Mediterranean sort of countries, it feels like it's much more part of the culture still there. And even we'll get on to sort of eating outdoors, but the alfresco community aspects, even the neighbours getting involved too, which we feel like we've moved away from that slightly, I think, in this country. But that's the bit I really fell in love with, the community aspect, the coming together. And again, that sort of primal nature almost, as it was coming together around the campfire almost, cooking there for cooking and sharing these bits and tales as you would do together as a community. So there was a human aspect to it that I enjoyed from the start, and it just got me to explore more.
Yeah, I love to hear that. But I know that as part of your story during your teens, you found yourself less happy, less enthusiastic than this version of Harrison that we experience now. Let's go back to that time and just understand what was going on and kind of the different ways that you handled that.
It was again, quite an overnight thing, really. I mean, I was quite an extroverted sort of child. Again, I think we were talking earlier about sort of we can speak to anyone sort of thing. I was kind of, you know, happy-go-lucky child and nothing really untoward there. So often people look at maybe there's a trauma point there that started what was to come, but I really can't see anything major that sort of switched this. For me, it was almost like heading into puberty, sort of major change, sort of around sort of 13, that time. A lot of changes going on, of course, with your body as everyone goes through that sort of time. That I found this almost just a complete change in my head, that all of a sudden I was going from this carefree, you know, no worries at all, and just going about my life as you would do, carefree child, to all of a sudden being hit with all these sense of complete sort of self-loathing, demotivation, insecurities, you know, self-critique, you know, and these battles are sort of, again, my own existence, not really understanding where I was, my purpose, what was happening, and not really knowing what I was going through at that time. I mean, there wasn't really, I suppose, through the childhood then, any maybe role models who were speaking about this sort of stuff. There wasn't much maybe help sort of through the school side of things. And it was something that, again, I think we were coming out from that quite maybe previous generation culture of sort of men just suck it up, carry on, and those elements, you know, boys don't cry sort of elements. And I think it was something that I just didn't know how to deal with it. And it became quite quickly the new sort of norm. And I think I just felt, well, this is it now. Like, I don't know what I'm going through, but if I say to anyone what's going on, then I'm going to be a bit of a downer, being a burden on people. So I just kept it to myself. But it was something that was the start of really a battle with my own head that's continued ever since, but from 13 onwards.
Yeah, it's incredible that we've just brought up there such good things from previous society, but then noted that there's elements of the kind of famous phrase that gets said on almost every podcast is around toxic masculinity, where it was a case of like, oh, even at that age when you are still a child in your teens, in my opinion, and being told to suck it up. And now there's elements of let's build a stiff upper lip, let's build resilience. But if there is this self-loathing, this radical change in terms of your ability to feel happy and to be the extroverted Harrison that we enjoy now, and probably we're seeing you were as a child, a younger child as well, then there probably does need to be some sort of conversation about why has this changed? what can we do to move it forward? Let's understand what these challenges are. But at that age, it's so hard to verbalise.
I mean, I was very much still there, I think. It felt a bit sort of like you were wearing two masks in a way. You know, you put on that mask to go out each day. And I think, you know, not wanting to showcase what I was going through, so I wouldn't really try and reveal the true identity behind the scenes sort of thing. And I think both were very much me. I think I was always in there throughout the whole duration of what we'll come to later. But for very much, I don't think it was a case of those around me telling me a way to be, or that being leached into me, or perhaps, you know, a role model or a father or a masculine figure pushing me that way. I think it was just a product of the environment to a way. I mean, the stuff you were watching, maybe, you know, the television shows or the bits there, or always, you know, the heroes doing this sort of thing, going out strong, they win the day, they beat off the bad guy and sort of thing, and they continue on. Or other bits again, sort of sporting way, it was all there in terms of the environment. It was always just strong male characters, no issues, that was it. The emotions were for the women, perhaps, and sort of thing. And it was, I guess, that subconsciously does sort of leach in a way. And you wouldn't expect maybe the previous generation as well, maybe teaching their sort of sons from the war elements, that perhaps they had a very much had to keep calm, carry on was the mantra, wasn't it, sort of thing, which maybe leached into their sons and daughters that then maybe passed on to us. So it just felt like a natural transition. But one that really, I think, this sort of day and age now is much more spoken about, I think, and much more identified with. But back then, you just felt hugely alone, I think, and not knowing really, you were the only one going through this. This was very unusual, but this was now existence.
Yeah, it really was. And that was throughout your years at high school that you kind of felt this way. When did you start to try and deal with it, or what did you try and do to overcome it?
Well, I didn't really do anything back then at all. I think it was just a case of it felt like it was the crux to bear in a way. Again, I was probably known as being quite a jovial sort of the joker. I'd like to make people sort of, you know, happy. Maybe in a sense it was me sort of maybe trying to, hopefully that would rub off on me to a way, I think. Not class clown, but just generally just try and be someone that was maybe good fun to be around and stuff. And I had many friends, which I still have to today. They're from school. There was a close-knit group of friends from those days. But internally, when you were going back to sort of my own four walls, you know, it was just a constant battle in the head. And just, again, like those masks I said I was wearing, you take it off at home and all of a sudden that was it. It was a safer space. But really, you were just then going through the day again. What did I say there? Was that the right thing to say? What did you looking in the mirror? I don't like this. And maybe comparisons again with perhaps other figures and magazines and other elements. And it just really began this destructive spiral for me, I guess, that wasn't something I even looked to attempt to heal or attempt to speak about until quite deep into sort of early adulthood, really. At this time, I was working a lot too. I found myself working like in the hospitality trade. I got a job sort of 13, back of house in the kitchens. Although food had been that sort of, you know, initial interest, it certainly wasn't something I pursued as a career. It was just, you get a Saturday job, that's kind of what you do. My mum, again, single parent sort of way. It was helping to get a bit of pocket money for myself to do what I like. So into work, and that was it. And again, I enjoyed that culture. I was quite an old head, young shoulders, would happily talk to the old boys in the pub and various bits, enjoy hearing their stories, what they got up to, and just basically behind the scenes, washing up the pots and pans, I guess. And that led on to maybe more waiting on when I got a bit older in the hotels, into cellar boy activities, and then 18, becoming obviously legally obliged to be able to dispense alcohol behind the bar. So a natural transition into now front of house role. And this was really the point for me too, obviously going into that maybe adulthood point, and 18 being such a kind of critical culturally switch on this island for sure. It was my first introduction really to alcohol, and I wasn't someone that, you know, was hiding down sort of the, I guess down the park or and the bus shelter sort of drinking in my teens sort of thing. I was quite, maybe didn't really adapt too much. I'd tried little bits with my mum and dad, but wasn't really something I strived for. I was much more interested in sort of, you know, keeping up with my football really, football scores and stuff at home. But that sort of life there, again, being behind the bar, meeting those people and then enjoying a drink after work, initially was very social and kept me out of my own head. Because always when it was going back to just me at home, that's where the problem sort of started. When I was occupied, it was kind of okay. Things were there. So finding something, keeping it busy almost. But then alcohol then, I mean, I suppose my tolerance was very poor. Of course, 18, just starting off drinking, as we all do, that cultural change. You know, it was 1, 2, 3 pints, heading home, absolutely bladdered, sort of, that sort of way. But quite like the sensation it gave me, that freedom, that sort of almost shutting the head off, that lubricant that we have socially these days. So that became quite an addictive sensation, I suppose, early on, something I wanted more of.
It was escapism that early on?
I don't think I identified it that way at the time. I think it was very much, again, it felt very cultural. It felt very much a natural transition. I'm 18 now. You go and get your first pint at the pub. I'm now with the men. Here we go. This is what we do. You know, and again, there was still that element perhaps as well, you know, matriarch women cooking in the, at home in the kitchen, Sunday dinner, we all go down to the pub. That was quite ingrained in that sort of generational culture. And it felt very much something that was, that's the natural way we do. We, that's what we do now, 18. We head out. Everyone else sort of catches up. I was one of the older people in my school year. Some friends have caught up later on as they got 18. And quite quickly, I enjoyed that lifestyle. I was going out. I made new friends in that sort of environment. Worked more and more in the pub. And began, I suppose, to seek more opportunities to go out. Because really, I was now getting the sensation from this liquid that was allowing me to have that freedom that I had before all this started sort of at the 13. So it was something that I think was beginning to become something that was going to have a key part in my life for a longer period in my life, but wasn't really aware of it at the time.
Yeah, at that point in time, particularly as you're saying, when you finish the hospitality shift, it's natural that the staff have a drink or two afterwards. So you partaking in that is nothing out of the ordinary, but it's maybe ticking a different box for you than you maybe realized at the time. Like you say, it was, oh wow, I feel a little bit better after this. When I go home after the shift, when typically maybe I would have these challenging thoughts, and you were saying comparing yourself or analyzing things that you said, an element of self-loathing, that kind of disappears if you go back with the Dutch courage that you've just instilled in yourself, and you go back and maybe just you go to sleep, whereas previously you would go back and you would ruminate.
For sure, and always an active mind at night as well. I mean, I think I mentioned yesterday, I'm quite the night owl sometimes. So that
polar
was almost
opposite to me. Yeah, I'm useless anytime after 9 o'clock.
It seems to be that's when I just come alive. It seems the thoughts all come into play there. But I've never had a problem sleeping. To be fair, though, I can sleep anywhere. I think, you know, I'm a sort of a bit of a rubbish superpower really of mine, I think, but still very much an active mind at that time. But that sort of slowed it all down, as you say, sort of the alcohol side of things. So it became something that initially was one or two, was then heading out more regularly. I was meeting friends in that space. Peers, colleagues that were working in that environment, they'd then be saying, I'm finishing my shift Wednesday, you're coming down, lived in the town. So I ended up walking down. And before I knew it, really, I was going out most nights of the week, sort of down to the pub. And of course, my tolerance was building at this point as well. So I was more exposed to this substance. You know, what was 2-3 pints was now turning more into sort of 5, 6, 7. And then by sort of about 19, I was still studying at the time. I did an extra year at school and the college, some more A-levels. And by that sort of age, I was going out most nights of the week, and I was regularly known as quite a heavy drinker, big drinker. But again, that was that male bravado sort of thing there. You didn't want to be known as a lightweight in sort of the male culture. So I was known as a good drinker, hollow legs, off we went, and just
he can put it away, that kind of chat.
Yeah, which again, it's all ingrained in the culture, isn't it? I think all the time, heading out straight away, how we almost belittle the fact that it's like, you can't drink much, we don't want to drink. Maybe less so with the next generation coming through. But then it was still, maybe in the country, the rural element as well. It was very much something that was a natural activity to move towards. So by this point now, I think I was experiencing what I saw was almost a bit of a medicinal help now with this substance. It was something that I enjoyed the sensation it was giving me. Obviously, my tolerance had grown, so it was taking longer for me to get to that period where I wanted to be, which was almost that shut off, that happy medium of being in this ethereal sort of state before we then teetered over the edge and went into almost oblivion. So that was pushing on more and more. So I almost sought out that sort of feeling, that sensation for my own head, because it was really the period that was most carefree. So now we were getting to maybe 8-9 pints, and I was like, this is a nice space. I feel like myself. I feel as if I'm not being judged. I feel as if I'm confident to do elements. And of course, at that point, I'm pissed. I mean, I'm all along the way. Then a few more the way, and mine just shuts off, and it was blackout sort of thing. So stumbling home, waking up, don't know what's going on, and we start again. And this was around the period, I guess, that I was moving on with my sort of studies. I'd been accepted into university, and I was about to move away to a different city.
Academically, you could function quite well with that level of intake the night before.
So I think I've always been maybe one of these individuals that I remember a bit coaster. I was academically strong. I was in sort of good groups in school for that. My grades predicted were high, but I was someone that didn't really apply myself. I was kind of someone that really would just turn up on the day. I mean, a lot of the time I was just sat at home, maybe previously watching something on the telly or playing on the PlayStation. I just wander down for the exam sort of at that time really and come out with passable grades sort of thing. So really one that was maybe abusing his potential to a degree, but not really identifying with the structures that were in place either, thinking it was, you know, I can do what you want me to do, but I'm not really agreeing perhaps on all these fronts. That
you can tell you're
through.
Capable, like you, the way you speak now, the way you hold yourself, the things that you've gone on to do, there's clearly capability there, but it wasn't being channeled.
Perhaps so. I mean, I always found myself, when I was working in the sort of practical environments, I always found that was, I'd always put my all into it. I was always, you know, grafting to the fullest. I'd stay as long as I could. I'd do that. I'd finish the job, never leave it half done. But academically, although there was elements, I enjoyed learning. I enjoyed the aspects of there and the teaching. But sometimes I just felt as if it wasn't quite, I don't know, it was just ticking a box. So it was kind of just, this is what we want to do. Or this is a theory we believe in, or this is the theory to talk about. I'm like, well, I don't agree with that. I think there's a constructive element towards that. But it's like, no, this is the theory you're writing about. It's like, okay, well, I can do that for you, but I don't agree with what I'm writing. So I fell a bit behind on that sort of front, but still achieved the grades needed to go to university at the time. Now, again, that felt like a natural progression. It felt like that was the structure I was going into. That was where I was getting channeled through sort of the academic system, was kind of, this is the next step. You're capable, so you're going to university. No idea what I wanted to do. No, clueless. You know, again, careers advice sort of thing at the time. It was just seemed to be, this is the job you're doing for the next 45 years of your life, and that's it. And then you retire.
What did you go and study?
So I chose business in the end. I chose business management. There was a spell where I was trying to go into more of a dentistry line at one point. So I studied sort of chemistry, biology, that sort of way. But I think, I wasn't applying myself, so I wasn't going to get the grades required.
You would need
all these
for dentistry.
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, I think there was an element of hand dexterity as well, which my hand at this point was probably getting a bit shaky by the morning with the booze side of things too. So that probably wasn't a good look. I did have some interviews at some universities for that, but wasn't something I then pursued. So I had a bit of a year where I went out to college. I went down like a media route sort of thing, sort of photography, film, that were aspects I enjoyed. I liked that sort of side and didn't think there were subjects that I could study at that time.
There's really a little hint towards future as well.
Perhaps,
which
as well.
Is,
I mean, it's funny how it goes full circle, isn't it? I think you've picked up elements from all these through your time, and nothing's sort of not worthwhile. But at the time, it was kind of, well, I'd enjoy that, so I'll try and channel it. But then I came back full circle and felt that my traits maybe suited business and maybe management side of things. So I went back and I did another year in school, went back from college and did that A-level in a year to then go to university doing business. So at the time, there was no real end goal. It was not sure what I wanted to do afterwards. It was just, I felt like I'll go into that structure because I've got people skills, I've worked in that environment, I can do my sums, and I felt business was maybe ticking those boxes. So I moved away to university, and then again, it was quite a quick jump. I mean, I didn't get into my first choice, again, being that coaster. I mean, I didn't get the grades they were expecting me to. I think I had turned down unconditional at one point as well, which was maybe, wasn't far enough away from home, I felt. I think it was Northumbria, which, yeah, was only down the road from Carlisle, so I wanted to go a bit further. And I ended up in York at the time, so I went to St John, was the university there. And literally the letter came in. I didn't think I'd got in. I'd actually started looking for work because nothing had come through the door. So I felt as if, okay, this is not to be. Let's try and get into the working world. And then I came back. I think I'd been camping in the lakes with some mates. And I got back and there was a letter on the doorstep and said, you've got in. The course starts Monday. This was Friday. So literally, I went up to my mum and said, I've got in, you know, and again, kind of took it in its stride. I'm that sort of, maybe I've always been that kind of character. I'm not sort of exuberant about this news. I was kind of like, oh, this has happened now. You know, this is another door that's opened.
Particularly that point in life as well, where you're not necessarily direction towards that. You're not optimizing for, look, I'm going to get into this course and this is going to happen. It's just a case of, I've applied for it because it seems like that might be the right thing to do, but I'm also looking at these options as well. So whatever happens, what may be will be at that point.
Yeah, I think that's maybe a mantra maybe I've always had, sort of, you know, the que sera sera, to a Doris Day reference. It's kind of, yeah, just seeing what comes, really. I think maybe that has been quite a negative trait at times as well. Maybe perhaps, you know, you've got to put the work in sometimes to make the opportunities yourself. But I've also been that sort of, again, well, I suppose it's coasting, really, to some degree. Not the laziness aspect, because I mean, when I've worked, I've always put my effort in there, but just not applied it in other structures. But this letter came anyway, and it was literally a case of walking through to the lounge. Oh, I've got into university, Mum, I think. So I sent the letter over. And then that was it, starting the ball rolling. So we quickly jumped in the car that day. We made a few appointments to try and find some accommodation. At this point, all the student property had gone because it was that late. So it was looking at private accommodation. So we found a few bits, went to York for the day. On the way there, these accommodation bookings got cancelled. Someone had taken them. We got a secondary one, which was just up to no good at all, and drove back thinking, right, we'll try again tomorrow. So literally driving back to Carlisle, and then got a call on the way home. It's now available again. Do you want to come? So we went back to this property and signed on for this property that at the time wasn't in the most glorious state, but was kind of literally, well, this is the next step. We're going to sign for it. Maybe different aspects of what I was used to, but there we were. So again, that was it. The next day, we packed up the car and I was off to York. So Friday, the letter comes in. Sunday, I'd moved to York. And the course started Monday. Now, I'd never been to this university. I'd never been for an open day. I didn't know the city. My auntie lived outside York, so we'd been there for a day trip before. But I had no idea really where I was. I remember there was a girl that I knew from school who had actually gone to the same university. And I remember texting her going, where's the campus sort of thing on the first day? So I went in. So it was a shaky start initially. So I'd got there, but it was a bit sort of, you know, not quite the smooth transition into this phase of life that we needed. But that's kind of how I was at the time. But straight away, obviously, there we are starting university. What's the first thing we do for the first couple of weeks?
Freshers week, so it's party central.
Absolutely. So again, ingrained in there, again, it's how we meet people. It's that Dutch courage. It's that social lubricant. We're out there. Let's get on the drink. Now, again, I was a year older than a lot of the other people there. I've always felt I was maybe an older head as well. So I felt as if I was maybe even older, to be fair, than some of the crowd that was moving away for the first time, having that independence. When I was quite maybe an individual anyway, I was quite comfortable sort of doing things by myself and traveling about. And didn't really conform to, I suppose, the behaviours of how they were going about maybe the sort of the party. You know, I enjoyed perhaps going out and having the social beforehand and meeting, sort of talking there, where this was now moving on to a lot of drinking at home, sort of music that I didn't really enjoy, and sort of then getting absolutely bladdered in the flat and then heading out and doing as little as possible and going to dance. All those elements I despised.
Well, you'd grown up literally in hospitality and then chatting with the older guys in the pub, and that was your form of, this is how I'm going to have my evening.
Yeah, so I used to head out at the time and sort of go into some of the pubs around York and go there and crack a conversation and find out the stories of what they were doing or different ways of life these people had lived, as opposed to someone who was just chatting maybe celebrity gossip or what was going on with their neighbour down the hall. It didn't really interest me. It's sort of another gossip culture in a way. So it's kind of being a bit strange. And of course, accommodation-wise now, I was now living with third years in this house. I was away from that sort of culture. So thankfully, really, this girl from school that I knew was kind of a bit of a pivot point to introduce me to some people there, because quite quickly I was going to become possibly alienated in this city. Later, I did that by myself, but it was sort of something that quite quickly I was in that culture. I was already quite a heavy drinker before I moved away, a year older, so I was known as a bit of sort of that's what he does. He's going to come out, we're all going to go home after a few drinks, and he's going to outlast and go home. And quite quickly again, I fell back into thinking, right, well, you know, I was from single parent upbringing, didn't have quite the finances some of the other people had, so found some employment to sustain my education as well. So naturally, what have I done in the past? I've worked hospitality. So I found a job nearby at a local pub down the road from the university. I loved it, again, in that same sort of setting. Enjoyed the people I was working with, enjoyed that aspect. It was applied, it was practical, knew the task in hand, and it was earning me money, which was then fueling me to go out and socialise.
Of course.
But of course, I'm meant to be studying during this time as well. But again, I'm maybe not applying myself too much. I'm sort of, you know, being a bit lackadaisical on it. I've turned up to this course that I felt was pretty much just the A-level reboxed, but now basically, you know, a couple of hours touch time a week. Was then told it was all online, was quite savvy with my sort of tech, so just felt, well, I can just access this when I want, so I don't need to come in. So I stopped turning up, really. I'd still meet the gangs for the social afterwards, but just didn't really turn up for that, just worked instead. The university, of course, maybe didn't like this and sort of said, well, you know, you should be attending. And I felt, well, I'm paying for this, so sort of it was my choice, isn't it? But maybe a bit stubborn in that aspect, perhaps. But it was kind of, at this time, my lifestyle was getting a bit out of control, and maybe my early mornings certainly weren't happening. Again, night owl. And so I was missing a lot of the studies, and it was falling by the wayside. I was beginning to coast, but I wasn't now beginning to be able to catch up. But again, academically, I was doing okay. The coursework was going in, we were getting good grades, and it looked as if I was going to maybe squeeze through this stage as well, and then winter employment, and off we go. But quite quickly, really, the alcohol side of the life that was still being used medicinally now was beginning to become more of a poison for me.
So you had the kind of, just before you went to uni, 8-9 pints, you were hitting this point where you felt that escapism, that medicinal effect. And then obviously any more than that, you would black out and sleep till the next day. And then we go again later on that day. What was it like at this point?
So at this point now, it was becoming very much the focus for me. It was part of my routine, if you will. It was something that was the natural step. The minute I'd finished university for the day or I'd finished my work for the day, we'd go on the drink. And that was just it. And again, there were still a few of the students I was hanging around with that were doing the same, but they were sort of starting to drop off because they were now getting more into actually what they were there for and studying, perhaps, when I was kind of like, come on, we can do both. Work and play. They go together. Never really been good at balance. I think you'll get that theme throughout this. And so quite quickly, that was sort of the case. And then, of course, university aren't getting too happy because I'm not really turning up. And there's a particular chap, friend of mine, Josh at university, that we were kind of doing, we were different courses, but we were almost the same bit. We'd head out all the time, always out and about in sort of the student union, but then not turning up for our classes, waking up and going, oh, that's it, we've missed another lecture for the day. So I got pulled in basically by the university and said that, look, you're not turning up, what's going on? And I sort of basically felt as if I wasn't perhaps getting channeled sort of the right way. I felt as if I wasn't really feeling as if I was, I don't know what the word is, almost...
Stimulated?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it wasn't quite touching me there. And then also I was still suffering in my own head daily behind the scenes that there was one way to shut that off. So again, the logic there for me was kind of, well, I'm not being stimulated at university. Drink is kind of shutting my head off at night when I'm overstimulated and my head's, you know, really destructing. The job is funding that. So therefore, that's the priority. That's funding this vice. By which point now, you know, I'm known as quite a sort of daily drinker. I'm hanging out of these groups. I could be in the pub sort of the minute I finished the day. So if a lecture was finishing at sort of 11, 12, I was heading straight into the pub then and off we go for the rest of the day, unless I was working. And by this point, really, I was drinking sort of quite heavy units. So I was drunk pints sort of way. I was quite slow. I like that sort of guise of being social, but was drinking sort of in excess sort of 15 sort of pints now. Wow. Most days. I'd taken up smoking at this point as well, which was something I'd never really entertained before. But again, went part and parcel with that sort of trade and culture. It was kind of...
You would go outside for a fag with the guy you were drinking with. You would chat to them separately.
Yeah, or sort of hang around sort of the smoking terraces where there wasn't the loud music when you went sort of against the later night bars and stuff and you start chatting, take a drag. And I was working in the bar as well. It was a way to get a break and go out there and have it's just ingrained in that sort of working culture in that element. So at this point, university had basically fallen by the wayside anyway. It all gone. There was like an ultimatum that kind of, you know, I took and just ran away from it, really. I felt as if at this point now, that wasn't what I was focusing on. Again, I didn't really tell anyone at home what had gone on. I was now going full-time into the sort of pub work and just trying to really sustain this balance of really was me existing in a way at this point. Now, this continued on. So I mean, I'd never stab at university at one point, tried to get back and tried to maybe speak about my issues and stuff, but that didn't work out. But
I was going to ask, do you think the university, you mentioned you were a paying customer, but do you think they had a duty of care to try and identify why this student is failing? Like what are the issues? Because if they delved deeper, maybe they could have found that it was becoming alcoholism at that stage.
It's something I've not really spoken about before in conversations too much, but I never put any blame on them at the time. I think likewise, I mean, I'll talk later on as well about sort of the medicinal help and stuff I received, but like, I felt very much that this was obviously mine. I didn't expect them. They shouldn't have had to make the statement of going, look, intervention sort of moment or bits there. It was my place to do that. And I wasn't providing that opportunity too. But I did go back the second time on appeal and trying to come back in again. I did speak briefly about something I was going through at the time, but it wasn't almost...
How could you at that point in time, could you verbalize that I'm reliant on this alcohol?
I didn't mention alcohol at the time.
Okay. You so, talked more about the depressive thoughts, yeah, and the self-loathing and the challenges you had in that respect.
But I didn't know it to be depression at the time. It was kind of just, you know, I'm suffering in my own head a bit. I feel like I'm not really here. I'm kind of just...
You didn't use the trigger words. It's so unfortunate that the language wasn't there that would potentially set the alarm bells ringing for the right people to get involved. And that's very wrong, because you shouldn't have to use a particular phrase, a particular set of words for people to be like, okay, we're actually going to have to need give this gentleman some sort of help that he's not currently receiving. Equally, I respect that you're having a lot of personal responsibility there and saying that I wasn't actually in a position where I was necessarily welcoming the help or the intervention moment that was necessary.
Again, as well, I think it didn't come naturally at that point. I felt I shouldn't be speaking about this. This is not an issue that's publicly acknowledged sort of at the time. It's kind of, this is my own issue. There's no other way to go about this other than sort of my own day to day. I just live with this. This is it now. So I mean, at 13, I started going through this. So we're already at 19 by this point, and I have 6 years down the line of battling, I suppose, my own internal cognitive thoughts. And it was pushed on the way, and I did get back in. I mean, I had a big sort of D-Day meeting. It was all, I remember it being a sort of scary one. My friend had a similar one because he'd not been turning up, and he was like, it's fine, it's just the head of program there. Just tick the boxes and he'll be back on. Mine turned up and it was like the registrar was there and the head of program, there was the deputy dean was in. There was like a big room of four, like walking into like Dragon's Den or something. And they sort of said, you're not being turning up, Harrison. And I was like, oh, yeah, I've not been in. You want to come back? What's going to change? And I was like, oh, I don't know. I just want a second chance, really. And then they basically then gave me an ultimatum again. I said, I've got to turn up all the time. And they did try and put me on. They did push me to a counselling element at the time. So there was obviously behind the scenes over there. But I don't think they believed what I was saying. I think they just felt I was a chancer. And I was kind of like, you know, I'd failed. I'd gone out. My grades were good. So that was kind of what was keeping the appeal to come in again. But I wasn't turning up, and I wasn't doing the university thing.
Student at all, yeah.
Absolutely. I was an open university almost. I was kind of just, I'll do it. I'll hand the coursework in. See you later. Didn't talk to anyone around there. Most of my friends are in the pubs now. They weren't sort of in the student gang. So they let me back in, but that quickly fell by the wayside again. So there was some help there. So again, I don't like to put down on them at the time. Perhaps there's better things now in place, but at the time I wasn't giving them the signs, as you say. So I went back into the pub trade and we continued on. And this is where things really began to begin to spiral deeper for me and become quite dark.
It's incredible. And I think there's a lot to be said for you recognizing that while the university weren't perhaps equipped to help you in the best possible way, you also weren't in a position to say, look, these are my problems. These are the challenges I'm facing. Can you help? It was more, look, can I just get back in and have a second chance at this, a second bite of the cherry when it comes to academia, shown by the fact you were ticking those boxes in terms of the coursework, but clearly not present. Clearly, there's an element of that this should be spotted, that this is a red flag in terms of how this individual is maybe looking after themselves away from their class.
I wasn't helping myself, I think, either at the time. I think there was certain things in life. Yes, you can have the moments where people lift you up and people provide support. And I think they felt as if they were maybe doing that under maybe the curriculum they had at the time. It's probably changed a lot since. But I also wasn't really engaging with that program they were putting me on. So it was kind of like, well, we're offering him the carrot here. He's not biting. So it's difficult. You got a difficult one again, sort of sticking the carrot sort of thing, isn't it really? But for me at the time, money was fueling this, which was fueling my head, which was giving me the escapism. That made the logical sense. And I sort of enjoyed that aspect and felt practically engaged in that environment. So I went full-time into the trade. Now at this point here, I'm literally known as a heavy drinker. I'm friends with the guys there. I'm in town every night after I finish work. It's starting to seep into my work life where I maybe turning up late for early shifts and stuff, or sleeping in, which I maybe still do a bit now, to be honest. It's not all drink, but it's it was certainly worse because I was just completely blackout. And I was drinking now at this point in heavy excess, and it was starting to show physically as well. So it's not just a case of he's turned up, or he's had a few drinks sort of again. I'd put a lot of weight on at this point as well. So I'd ballooned in weight to about 22 stone at this point.
Wow.
When I was about 15 stone when I started university. So quite a physical change.
People neglect the fact that alcohol has a lot of calories in it as well. But then with that comes the sedentary lifestyle of sleeping in long. You're not exactly going to be out and about exercising because you're hungover or feeling rough. The smoking as well. You're not exactly the pinnacle of health from that perspective.
Not at all.
And also, I mean, whenever somebody, if anyone listening, when they've been hungover, they make worse choices with their food because you're chasing some sort of sustenance quickly to try and get me back to a baseline level. So yeah, you're going to eat the hyper palatable, high calorie foods, which just add to the waistline.
Exactly the way it was going. And again, in that pub environment too, sometimes you're working on a shift. It was kind of just literally picking up what you got to hand, which was usually a few chips that'd been left over in the bowl in the bar. So off you go. So this was really beginning to scale now, and to the point where I was literally probably hair of the dog next morning, having a can when I was waking up, sort of thing, cracking beers out when at home. I didn't really drink much at home. I was always going out. I always tried to remove myself from home because home was kind of the issue. Not a traumatic period. Again, the family life was great at home. Student life was okay as well. But that was where I was stuck in my head. So I went out and had the illusion of being social, which I was. I mean, I was known as a good conversation holder in various bits, but it was always kind of that was occupying my head. And the drinking sort of went with it as an element, which was aiding that, but also then...
One of the stereotypes for alcoholism is the person sinking a bottle of gin or a bottle of vodka or a bottle of whiskey in the house by themselves, which I think is so clear that that's a problem because that's just not a behavior that can ever be sustainable. But because under the guise of connecting with people and being social, you're out and about all the time, people maybe assume it's less of a problem. But when you look at the volume and the units that you were taking in and the after effects that it was having throughout the rest of your life, it's clear that yes, although I'm drinking with people, I'm I'm maybe doing it more for the substance at this point in time than the social connection, which is clear that when you say things like, oh, I was looking to get out and away from the room where I was having these bad thoughts, brilliant. But I was doing it in a self-sabotaging way because when I was out, I was consuming this substance, which was entrapping me at this point.
But still not conscious to it either. This is the thing at the time. You just go...
Well, what we're doing is post-op rationalising. I understand that.
But it's kind of, you look back now and you think, well, how did you not sort of see at this point that this doesn't logically make much sense now, does it? But I'm there to these levels. But again, it was, for me at this point now, this was how I was existing as a human being. I was battling my own head. At this point, I mean, again, from my adolescence as well, suicidal ideations, not wanting to be here, wanting to sort of leave this planet, feeling as if there was no purpose for me. What's my escape? It's just turning the switch off. You know, my own personal switch. And it was constantly going towards that avenue. But the thing that was almost keeping me there all the time was what I'd leave behind, I think, the impact I'd have on other people. Because I never wanted to be that burden. As I said at the start, yeah, it was never about bringing other people down. So it was always me trying to make as little impact as possible on other people,
yeah,
whilst really managing my own sort of self-destructiveness. But of course, as we know with sort of addictions and substances, they're a great dissolvent. And it's not a dissolvent of problems. It's a dissolvent of everything else around you, relationships, finances, all those elements. So without me really knowing, this was starting to have an effect that I wasn't aware of. And it got to around my 21st birthday. A lot of friends come to visit me in York in this city, and by which point I was touring around between about four different groups who basically they channeled what I needed. I did my quota at the time, my quota of where I wanted to reach, where I shut off, which at this point now was probably in excess of 20 pints. Always pints, because I felt I didn't like the quick 0-60 approach of spirits or even drugs. I wasn't sort of going into that avenue. I mean, dabbled, but hadn't enjoyed that aspect. Liked a bit of control and a slow, steady demise under this social guise. But literally, I was going out now with the first boys in the pub in the morning, meeting the guys after work at 5 who come out after the offices, then meeting the evening crowd and then into sort of the bar club scene and usually walking home and the last place shut sort of thing. And literally just going through and going to work each day. There was a time here where I started living in the pub as well. So I'd moved up. So I was functioning. I mean, I'd gone to management level in the pub now. I was functioning at the same time.
How well can you function when you're in that level of inebriation? Is it a case of doing things that are well within your wheelhouse and your capabilities and you just rinsing, repeating over and over again? Because I guess one of the challenges the university had was you were clearly capable, but you weren't showing up. Whereas in this pub environment, you were capable of ticking those main boxes, but maybe they weren't able to give you too much more responsibility because you weren't as reliable due to the drink.
There was certainly an element of that. I mean, I think there was, you know, if I hadn't turned up all the time, of course, you'd be fired, you know, your job, wouldn't you, sort of thing. But there was bits sometimes where I'd slip, I'd maybe sleep in, I'd be late, and they'd be sort of told, you know, like, this can't happen. But usually it was always come back to the fact that, well, he's a good worker when he's here, he's going above and beyond. That kept you sort of going. So there was probably a few ultimatums.
Personality is a big thing as well. Yeah. It really is. And you're very likable. Like, you and I both know that just from getting to chat to this. But there's an element of, and any alcoholism that I've been around, there's very different types of alcoholic. I think you notice when somebody is a very sad or an aggressive alcoholic, but you're talking about being quite a conversationalist, seeking these different social groups to interact with when you are drunk and have these chats and maybe don't want to be in the smoking area rather than on the dance floor because you want to be chatting and chewing somebody's ear off. And that for me, if I'm, again, post-op rationalizing, it's that element of like, I get to talk to somebody else and not just sit inside these top few inches of my head where the pain is.
And sometimes it's just listening. I enjoyed other people's conversations and hearing how maybe they go through life and what they do. And that was quite an interest of mine, really. So I enjoyed who you met and how that environment allowed you to meet people from all different walks of life that you perhaps wouldn't have come across normally. So I was a big advocate for it. And I felt that everyone should have gone through that phase because I think it really brought out some personal traits. I think it's still something that working in that trade is a great thing to do. But of course, if I was turning up to an office job, stinking of booze each day, bleary-eyed, late, there's going to be a problem called up there. HR is probably going to go, hang on, this isn't right. Or his coffee cup now is getting filled with booze sort of thing. You know, it's not.
Did you ever get caught doing that or was it a secret?
I think, yes, it's just ingrained in it. I think at the time, because everyone's doing the same. If you're honest, a lot of people you may be serving are perhaps probably people who may be struggling a little bit as well. There's those that come in maybe on the Friday once a week, you've got more, a bit more control. But the guys who are in every day, the people that have become friends and regulars, perhaps sometimes, I mean, not to my place to say,
they have their demons as well. Yeah.
Perhaps, I mean, some of them maybe are fine that they do, but that's a different conversation, isn't it? But it's those who I was working with as well, they're all known as drinkers. We all had a drink after work. We all had a fag after work, not to the same level. They tended to find a time to go home. But, you know, getting caught doing that sort of thing wasn't a...
It wasn't an intervention moment, okay. Whereas I suppose if somebody in the office, like you say, the 9 to 5 comes in and at lunch they've gone and put something in their Starbucks, you're thinking, right, okay, this is a serious issue. But in that environment, when you're surrounded by it, you're just getting high on your own supply to some extent.
For sure. And again, you're in an environment that smells of the stuff anyway, so you're kind of hiding that sort of sense. But as you say, I think some people said sometimes that, you know, a bit like the BFG, I wasn't like an aggressive drunk. I wasn't someone that got, you know, highly verbal or bits. I just got a bit sleepier, more sedated.
I was going to say, how did you change? Because like I say, you see those drunks that become violent and you know that somebody is just another few drinks away from a potential altercation. You get those drunks that, like you say, fall asleep all the time. But you were out for such a long period of time. What were you like?
I think still very sociable. I think I'm happy to talk to people. People talk to you. Sometimes, again, they come up and you're like, well, they're a bit drunk, aren't they? The irony.
But this was your arena. Mm. You were used to having that level of inebriation, so you could probably hold yourself together for slightly longer. I mean, 20 pints, I mean, that is
it's daft. Yeah. I mean, at the time I wore it like a medal, you know, and it was, but these days I look back and I go, well, what achievement is that? But it's kind of, at the time as well, I think for me, this is where the tolerance comes in. I think this is my understanding of maybe addiction too, where initially I was trying to always reach that point of euphoria. That release moment that I think we look for in a lot of avenues. I think we always want that dopamine hit or wanting to be happy. Ultimately, I think that's what it's about, wanting to be happy. And whether you get that from, you know, poor vices like perhaps alcohol or drugs or anything that way, or it's through exercise, or it's through sex, or it's through adrenaline, they're all achieving the same aim, which is that endorphin boost. But for me, that got further and further away. So as tolerance built, that euphoric moment was now further down the road. So I was chasing that moment, having to get further to get to it. But then because I was doing more, which was then having the adverse effects, I was now starting even further back than I was in to begin with. So I see it a bit like if you're underground, it was almost like if ground zero. I was then sort of sometimes underground. And by the time I'd had sort of 6 to 8 pints, that was me back at zero. So I hadn't noticed the effects. I was completely, what I'd class as sober there, which is ridiculous. But that was me feeling sober. And then going on and chasing that moment of euphoria again later on, which then usually goes past that point into blackout, into oblivion. And that was the cycle. And some days you wouldn't reach that level. You'd sort of carry on and chase again the following day because you must drink yourself sober. Ridiculous, really. But it was I was just a heavy drinker. I didn't see myself as having a problem at all. But again, I had a lot of friends come to visit for that birthday again, 21st birthday, a bit like the 18, British culture once again. What do? We go out and have a big piss up. So it was a 5-day bender, which was run of the mill for me back then. And they all came to this city and we had a great time. And one by one, they started to go home again from this city. And it began to dawn on me how actually alone I was in this city. I was working, I was very sociable, I knew a lot of people. People would wave to me in the street, but I didn't really have any close connections. You know, I classed my friends at the time were bartenders, takeaway owners. Again, the signs were there. And one particular time I walked home in the early hours of the morning, that last friend was about to go home the next day. And the reality of what I was maybe going through in my own head, I just reached a point where I just saw no other element. And I was quite reclusive at the time. So I didn't have a phone. I didn't like to be contacted. I sort of, you know, I got in touch with people when I wanted to get in touch. I just went about my business.
It's a control element again.
Possibly again. Yeah. I picked up this phone, anyway, payphone. 4 a.m, again, we use payphones now. And a payphone, I picked it up, dialed home multiple times to try and wake my mum up and wake her up in the end. And I don't remember too much of the conversation in complete honesty, but my intention of this call was to say one thing, and that was goodbye. I felt like I couldn't go on. I felt alcohol wasn't giving me this escape anymore. I was chasing that euphoria, but it was a constant. I couldn't achieve that anymore.
Yeah.
And I'd already battled these moments of, you know, you're contemplating, you know, how you did it from a very early age, sort of, you know, on the internet there, I'm sort of searching through bits that you shouldn't be looking at that age sort of stuff. But battling through, and I felt at this point now that this was how I was existing through life and this was no longer serving my existence. So I was turning it off. And I lived close to the train station, so my plan was just to step on the tracks and that would be it. But I felt as if I had that accountability. I wanted to say, I couldn't go without saying something. But looking back, I think that was probably my call for help. I don't think I really wanted to do it. I was that blind drunk at the time. It was kind of, you know, my head's going, this isn't right. You know, there's something holding you back there going, you've got to tell someone. And I was whisked back home to Cumbria anyway. And this really should have been the turning point. I was put in front of my family doctor who we knew quite well. I'd spoke about what had gone on. I mentioned when I was drinking, but again, didn't see it as an issue. I was a heavy drinker. I was a good drinker. That's it. It's just what I'm good at. Big lad. Fine.
Yeah.
Rugby lad culture sort of thing, maybe. Blokes as well, maybe. Again, young men. That was maybe sort of somebody else going out doing that. It would be seen as, that's not quite right. But it was one there, and there were some avenues explored. But again, I felt as if, no, they're not the right avenues to go down. I'm dealing with this the way I can deal with it. This is just my crux to bear once again. So I booked a ticket back to York. The next I've been back for a week, went back to York and continued this exact same life path for another 5 years. Now, almost annoyed that I let someone in, annoyed that I had a chink in my armour, I've revealed that I'm not quite mentally strong.
Yeah.
A few friends knew, my mum knew, that was a couple of family members. There was a weakness now, really, that I felt it was at the time.
And without, well, perhaps going too far into it, your mum's worry must have been an all-time high when you left again, because she'd heard you at your closest to wanting to not be there, and you then going back to that lifestyle and perhaps carrying on with the same level of drinking. She probably knows that if it continues to the full extent, it probably is going to end in one way as well.
Again, I suppose not having the... She was sober, compass mentis, yes, sleepy, but took that call in its full extent. I barely remember the call. Ringing home. So the impact that probably had on her was probably much greater. And there's something she said to me more recently that you know, she said she sometimes used to cry herself to sleep thinking that when she passed on in old age or various bits, that I'd be on the streets. I'd be that sort of level. I wouldn't get out of this element. And there was times where you're very close. I mean, I think there's quite a few times now, even sort of with other things going on, cost of living in various bits, that we can be one paycheck away. I mean, I was all over the place. I mean, credit card debts had racked up. I was lucky to receive a lump of inheritance from a great uncle that came into our trust when we were 21. Straight away, that was a way of me paying off some debts. And there, the bar tabs that were going on, I knew every pub in York that had a line clean night. There was 3 pints on the bar while they were cleaning the pipes. Off you go. They knew me. It was kind of a friendly bartender-bartender exchange. It was all avenues there. And then living in the pub too. And I mean, maybe if I hadn't reached that certain level, that quota in enough time, I was just topping up from top shelf as well. So it was so much there. It could have been so different. In this, you weren't that far away at the time. Yes, you're in a job, you're in a house, but you can see how easy it is for people to maybe get on the street sometimes. And you're not that far away from it yourself. So that was a difficult conversation, sort of having that one in more recent years. But at the time, I said I wasn't willing to make that change. Took myself back to York. And it really wasn't until... I ended up in a relationship that things maybe began to change for the better.
How did the relationship change things?
I mean, it was something I always wanted. It was something that I'd longed for, I guess, sharing the sort of experiences and things with somebody else. But I was already in a relationship at the time, and that was with alcohol. And the two didn't really coincide, but they wouldn't. I wouldn't allow them to, in a way. You know, I worked quite on sociable hours in the pub trade. Again, another thing in the hospitality trade. It's an industry I've got utmost respect for, but there's some elements, perhaps, you know, these are common themes in this environment. She was 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. So I could weave this lifestyle in and around. You know, I could have days where I'd work early doors. I had a long stretch into an evening shift the next day. That was the big one. You know, we're going to really hit it there. And then turning up to her house, you know, later each time, inebriated. You go, you had a drink today? No. You have, haven't you? Oh yeah, I've had 2 or 3. I'd had 8 or 12. You know, it was kind of just lies, little lies at the time. That were just white lies. They weren't.
You can't build something loving and trusting on that basis. Force of your likable personality aside, very, very difficult for her to trust in you that way.
I was still in there as well. It's kind of like, that's the thing at this time. It's sometimes people think it's, you know, Jekyll and Hyde, but it's like, I'm still who I am. I was just clouded, you know, perhaps, you know, and dazed by this solution. And as the relationship went on, got more serious, obviously the lines started blurring more. You know, there'd be little arguments here and there, that the way to counteract those arguments for me was always to go straight back out on the piss and forget about it. So I'd run away basically each time, run away from it. And one particular night, after a particularly heated argument, I'd gone out into the town and I'd acted unfaithfully. I'd gone out and I'd snogged someone else in this bar. Again, completely clouded of judgment, really. And again, it's still a difficult point to sort of analyze now, because it's just, I can't understand why I did that. Because again, the lying I was doing at this point, you know, the deceit, the disloyalty, they were traits that they were ingrained in me. You know, I wasn't that person. That's not who I am. And rightly so, this was, of course, the end of the relationship. It was discovered. You know, obviously a huge sort of, you know, emotional argument, breakdown, dramatic. And at the time, for me, it felt as if this was now a realization of how much I'd changed, how much this solution, this vice, this liquor, I was changing who I was as a person.
You're acting completely out of alignment with your values, because you're like, I wanted a relationship. I wanted to share these experiences. I wanted to be there for her. I wanted to be a positive influence. But then you do something that's completely away from that because of this. You're almost not yourself.
And it was losing to it I loved the most at the time as well. It was my own, completely my fault, my own actions. You know, I had to be accountable for that. You know, but again, it was almost like you were getting a puppeteer. You were getting channeled on the strings by something else, almost possessed, almost in a way. And it was something from that initial moment that obviously it was a huge breakdown for me, an absolute, you know, rock bottom, losing that. And I felt that was the day, really, 6th of June, 2016, that I came to terms with the fact that I was an alcoholic at this point. And I suppose initially I was trying to win her back. I was trying to win this partner back. I vowed to sort of, you know, I can change. I can do the usual sort of stuff. I can change. I can be different.
Heartbreak's a hell of a motivator.
100%. 100%. And of course, you know, for her as well, I think, you know, obviously completely broken as well. I mean, again, I never wanted to be that burden. But now, look, it's now hurting those around me deeply now, what I'm doing. And really, this is nowhere to go. So I vowed to leave it for my life at that point. I remember going to work the next day, completely sort of disheveled. You know, I don't think I'd gone out that previous night, because again, I just vowed to sort of quit the booze. And I did the breakfast shift, and my boss looked at me and said, "You don't seem quite right today." And I just broke down in tears in front of him. It's again, very out of character. I wasn't an emotional person. He said, "Go and take a minute outside."
There was a lot being stifled at this point, though, wasn't there?
Mm-hmm. Take a minute outside. That minute was about 7 hours. Sat outside, just staring at the wall, again, just contemplating where I was in life.
What was going through your head?
I don't recall too much, really. I think you were just analysing your actions, who you were, the fact I felt compromised as an individual, the hurt I'd put on somebody else, and the things that go with that, I guess. You know, the life we were making, we were just signed to move into a flat together. You know, I was on this path, I enjoyed this city, and it was all gone. And again, I'd almost been opened up now and exposed to everybody else. And my colleague John walked out. He came on shift to do his shift later on, and he came out of a pint glass and he said, "Yeah, I'll get this down here, this will sort you out." I just looked at him, I said, "I don't drink anymore, John." He said, "You what?" I said, "I don't drink anymore." And he'd literally seen me at the end of the bar for the past 5 years, you know, literally human vacuum cleaner, drinking anything that was going, anything that was left over, drip tray specials, the lot. "I don't drink anymore, John." And pretty much overnight, I decided I had to leave this city. I felt I had to remove myself from this situation. If I was to try and make this change, it was too much of a familiar space. The environment I was in, the job, the area, it was all identified with that lifestyle. So I left. I went back to Cumbria. I didn't say goodbye to anyone. I'd been there 7 years. I'd left my job, which I later, by letter, I sent back in the end. My girlfriend had gone, my flat. I just left and came back to Cumbria. And for the first time in my life, I went on my personal Facebook page at the time, and I wrote the reasons why I had to leave this city. Coming clean with the mental battle I've been facing for all these years, the subsequent alcoholism on the basis of that, and what I'd done to someone that I loved dearly at the time. Such a vulnerable moment. but I felt as if there was no other way to go. I was completely at rock bottom at this point. It was literally, there was two ways to go, and it was either up or it was complete shut off again. This is the moment. So what I had to lose at the point, I felt I had to be accountable. I'd done wrong. That was the right thing to do. My hands are up. Now, the support I received back from people from that moment, I'll never forget. It was just the comments that came in, the phone was ringing, people sort of, you know, gathering round, and friends that really I was lucky to have in my life at this point. There would have been moments where they'd almost said, you know, ultimatums, and we're not going to see you again if you keep acting like this. And I was close to those moments. And you do see this as well in addiction, where people get to a point that unconditional love does run out at a time. And it's a very, very hard moment. And I'm very thankful I didn't reach that point. But the people that lifted me up afterwards, you know, I wouldn't be here without it. Honestly, it was just phenomenal. And friends started turning up my doorstep. And I literally, to try and fill this huge void in my life now, I felt I have to fill this with something.
Well, look at the time you've got back.
Oh, I mean, days, days, weeks. I mean, literally my whole day. So sort of, that's what I'm doing.
We were joking when we were chatting this morning that I'm big into elective sobriety, so I don't come from a place of having an addiction to alcohol. But one of the key metrics you get back when you reduce your alcohol intake, time, money, calories, headspace, for me anyway. And you find that weekends are an awful lot longer if you don't have a hungover Saturday. So extrapolate that out to the mass scale at which you were behaving and what was happening to you. The amount of time that you have to fill could almost be a negative, because you've got this missing part of your identity, this missing part of your character, this missing part of your day, this missing part of your week, this missing part of your life that needs filled with something positive rather than negative. And I'm glad your friends were there to help you do that.
Me too. It was a huge moment of turning, really. And it was kind of, again, family were there as well. And initially I went to my auntie's house just outside York, because my mum was actually away on holiday at the time. So, I mean, I didn't drive anything at the time either, so I had nowhere going anywhere. And I went there.
Thank God you didn't drive.
I always have the limit. So I hadn't passed my test at that time, so yeah, for good reason. And they took me to theirs for a week, and I've always been very close to her. I'm the oldest of seven cousins. She's always been like a second mother to me, really, again. She's a big cook as well, so there's always been that link there. But they took me in for a week into that house, and it was a bit like almost like a rehab phase, I guess. It was kind of, that was sort of sudden removed into a cushioned
room. Yeah, because when you go from the volume that you're drinking of a substance to none, what are the withdrawals like?
So obviously, but this is a point where, I mean, obviously I'm not a medical professional, but this is something that is not advisable at all at that level. It can be very dangerous. I think even sometimes more dangerous than coming off sort of harder drugs. I think the withdrawal from alcohol, your body is so dependent upon that chemical now, it can cause major short shut off. I guess it's something I didn't really contemplate too much at the time. I guess my mind was so clouded, so thinking different directions. I mean, it was all over the place. It was rabbit in the headlights, wasn't it? But cold turkey straight away from those days. I threw my last pack of cigarettes in the bin. I sometimes joke these days, I even stopped having sugar in my coffee. It was kind of everything at once. It was but that was kind of it. I think there was so much going on. There was distractions and bits. And
some of that was the sugar in the coffee thing. It's like a performative action, throwing the cigarettes in the bin, pouring away the drink or moving away from the city. It's a, I don't want to say a death, because we've spoken about how close you were to potential suicide, but it was a destruction of a previous version of Harrison or a part of Harrison that needed to go. Like the part of Harrison that acted out of alignment in terms of being unfaithful, the part of Harrison that was not turning up for work or when he did, or was sneaking drink at work and just constantly, that needed to be destroyed. So like you say, going away and going cold turkey, perhaps from a medical perspective, very challenging, but from a symbolic and a change of identity perspective, quite important in the story that's to come.
I mean, there's a quote I love that sort of sums that up, saying sort of, whoever I had become had to die. And again, it was not die in the sense that obviously I've spoken about before, but that character that was almost in play, and that sort of that phase, that chapter of the life was closed. And yeah, it was very much something that I tried to, the withdrawals were definitely there. I mean, there was all sorts of cold sweats, from almost hallucinations to sort of banging headaches to lethargy to all sorts, and pining for it and thinking, you know, that's the easy escape. And this was constant. And again, sort of cigarettes, wanting a fag, that sort of way, this, and just really wanting that moment to shut off. But feeling almost, I suppose in a way, almost like trying to punish yourself. You're accountable now. This is the pain you've got to feel, sort of thing. But fitness was kind of the thing that I started to throw myself into. So at first, I mean, I choke now. It was trying to find my head close to hand. I'd done a bit of cycling when I was a kid, nothing, not road cycling, just mountain biking in the woods. And, you know, I did some team sports, had a bit of football, a bit of hockey. And so I didn't really have a background in it. And I'd never ran, so I couldn't do that sort of thing. Gymming I'd done a little bit before I went away. But I basically picked up my auntie's bike in the garage, which was a typical ladies bike frame with a basket on the front and a bell.
And you were 22 still at this point.
Yeah, there's me going, sort of cycling around the Yorkshire Wolds on this little bike, you know, again, just something to do. But again, almost not having that worry now of the outside perception, because there was so much going on. There was a new carrot now that was much more engaged to chase. And it was this partner at first. I mean, that was the initial stages there, and heading to the gym. And I returned home to Cumbria. Again, it was little walks out there, and friends started turning on my doorstep. I mean, particular friends, sort of Andrew, Craig, sort of Toby, Chris turned up, sort of thing. And they were like, let's go to the gym. Let's do this. Let's go for a walk out here. Let's go out for even a coffee, sort of thing. It was all little situations, not around alcohol. And one friend then turned up on my doorstep, Ryan, and said, we're going to go for a hike. Now, at the time, I knew nothing what to expect. You know, again, I was a completely lethargic lifestyle, as you touched upon before. And I didn't really have any equipment. So I'd never been hiking before. I mean, I lived so close to the Lake District, but you know, I never went out. I was just complacent. It was just hills to me. You know, I wasn't bothered. And I put on what I had to hand, which was, you know, an old sort of jumper I'd wear down the pub and some pair of swim shorts I think I had, and just these old scabby trainers that are probably much grip as a pair of bowling shoes, really. And he took one look at me and said, you can't go like that. The state of you. And I was like, well, you know, I've got nothing. I'm penniless, all sorts. I'm just clouded. And he literally put me in the car, drove off, pulled off at this outdoor store on the way to the lakes, pulled a pair of boots off the shelf on the counter and bought me these boots. Again, a huge show of support at the time. Again, faith, this new lifestyle. An hour later, he pulls up at the base of this mountain in the Lake District. For those that know, Blencathra. One of the higher mountains in the Lake District. So perhaps that goodwill initially was kind of at the time looking up going, what the bloody hell are we doing? And it was literally getting frog marched up this mountainside. So there's me blowing out my arse, you know, pining for my ex, heads banging from booze, staring at my feet, just going, what is this? You know, trying to get into this, just so much clouded judgments. But one foot in front of the other, pushing forward. I mean, God knows how long it took to get up there. We eventually reached the summit circle of Blencathra. Gasping for breath, really, almost. And my friend sort of looked at me and he said, right, we're doing Helvellyn next week. So a week later, it was the same again. Helvellyn's the third highest mountain in the Lake District. You know, I think it's classed as a Munro in this sort of area. It's one of the few that makes it into that classification. And again, the same again, up from the Filmier side and like a stone staircase to the summit. And here's me again. So we're literally 2 weeks off the booze at this point. Different life, a right switch overnight. Now we're going up this hillside. It was a June day. Sunlight we've got today in Glasgow, of all places. And the sun was shining bright in the sky, not a cloud. And again, the same bit, up this mountain. And again, it was just staring at my feet, just pushing through. And it began to feel a bit like it was a physical manifestation of what I was going through, that sort of uphill struggle.
Step by step.
Pushing on through that pain, not knowing the ultimate destination, perhaps not being able to see it, but having to have that blind faith that something was coming. And we eventually reached the trig point on the top of the mountain, and it just blew me away. It was like a new addiction was being ignited from that moment. Just looking down onto the ridge route there, Striden Edge, Red Tarn below, the Pennines, and that endorphin rush I was getting, of course, from the activity, the sense of achievement of scaling a mountain of that, maybe that highest mountain in this country anyway. And it was, I loved it. And it was a much longer euphoric period than alcohol ever gave me. You know, or the first drag in the morning on a cigarette. And that started this spiral. So a week later, it was Scafell Pike, the highest mountain in England. I think by a month, we'd gone down to Snowdon. We'd done Snowdon. Before the turn of the year, we'd gone up to Scotland and done Ben Nevis as well. So the three peaks now done in this sort of first sort of 4 months. I'd now sort of relocated myself to the lakes via a little cafe job I was working to try and again, trying to rebuild my life, trying to rebuild things there.
Fill the time,
leave
give
alcohol
you a focus.
Out of the way. Yeah. Yeah. So I was like, well, what can I do? Well, I've got, you know, like 14 years service trade experience, but I don't want to be around booze anymore. Well, going on a cafe. So I started training as a barista. I was in a cafe down there again. Similar sort of environment, but more routine. And again, the cafe is shut. The same sort of time. The pubs, it wasn't more in their evening shifts. It was one shift. Off we go. Routine was getting built. And this is where I met the owners of a local business in the area that offered me a job at the Blue, because I was doing a bit of sort of the techie stuff behind the scenes for the cafe, sort of the website bits, some of the spreadsheets and social media. And they'd been looking for someone in the area, basically who could use a computer. Which is a bit scarce in rural Cumbria at times. A bit scarce. I mean, the skill shortage is definitely apparent. And they basically went, well, we'd like to offer you a job. And at the time I was going, no, I don't want that. I'm not sure what I'm doing. I'm not settled here. I've got a goal. And my goal was to go back to York and get this partner back. That was my goal the whole time.
Like I said, heartbreak, it can be a hell of a driver, and thankfully it put you on a much healthier path again.
For sure. I mean, this was my Rocky IV montage moment. This was it. You know, that was playing in my ears and the headphones as well. I mean, I know one of your previous guests, Fergus, always goes on about how he doesn't like music when he's going, but for me, it makes me feel like I'm in my own movie. You know, I'm in there. Was running in, sort of going there, sort of last of the Mohicans, and all, but exactly, that's him. It's maybe that God complex or ego sort of coming into play there. This was maybe the euphoria of all sorts of things coming in at the time when it was a strange period. But I ignored that job at first. Later to come, that was to become my job and settle me in the area in various bits. But at the time, it was channeling this new direction completely. And that hiking then suddenly began to change into running. Which at the time, I couldn't run a bath. You know, I'd have absolutely laughed you out of the pub if you said I'd ever be going for a run. You know, I'd probably have said if you're going to a mountain, I'd laugh you out of the pub. But here I was then sort of going, right, okay, let's go for a run. So 1K became sort of 2, 3 became 5, 5 became 10. And by the turn of the year in December, that same friend had said, do you fancy a marathon? And again, I'm just like, you what? I mean, but right, okay, let's go along with this. And there we are, May 2017. Lining up at the start of this marathon and crossing the line. And it was just this huge, almost redemption feel. This is 11 months on from that date, I don't drink anymore, John, to this, and almost that sort of 26.2 miles, previously being 20 odd pints. It was just a huge sense of redemption, and almost one that perhaps maybe I don't really, couldn't comprehend myself at the time, but for those probably who knew me on the change point, must have been so bizarre. Seeing that absolute right turn. I mean, completely different person. At this point, I was coming up to a year sober, hadn't touched a drop. I'd lost all that weight now, so I'd lost about 7 stone by this bit here. And again, wasn't smoking and was living a completely different life path now on this new channel. And just shows how much is possible to change in a year. I mean, it was just, but again, could never have done that without the support from the start of being vulnerable.
Yeah, that vulnerability piece is massive, and of course it raises questions about could I have done this earlier, could I have made this change, but it took a kind of second compounding moment after your 21st to be like, look, I need to get off this path, I need to make this change. And then once you made that change, things accelerated so quickly, to the extent that you're running a marathon after 11 months, that you're going up hills on a weekly basis, that you're actually enjoying the outdoors, you found another job which is more interesting for you than just the social aspect that was enabling you within the pub environment as well.
It was a different life.
Where did
a different person, different life.
Where did the fell foodie start then?
So this was to come. This was coming at this point. So at the time, I was now enjoying the hills on the regular. I was running now. I was now running some of those fells I started off doing, and was now based myself in Grasmere, working for a company, Grasmere Gingerbread in the Lake District, running their e-commerce setup. So I was like an e-commerce manager, been given keys to this empire, purely by the fact that, you know, I was okay with computers as a kid, you know, not through the academic route. They did think I had a business degree at the time because I did do 3 years at university, but it was 2 stints and it was never finished. They know now, so this isn't any expose. but it was very much, you know, such a trust. Again, they trusted me almost to go, well, give this guy an opportunity. And that's what I felt like I needed. I felt like I was able, but maybe wasn't conforming to the practices I needed to be, and then perhaps was coasting at times. And you know, I didn't deserve an opportunity, but, you know, like anybody else, you've got to make them sometimes. But felt that if someone did entrust me, I'd repay that. So that was a huge sort of bit there, which led on to be very successful and a great channel, and it's allowed me to build from that point. But the fell foodie bit at the time was me. I mean, my cooking had been a big thing that I brought back into my life. So again,
you had lots of time again. Yeah, so let's prepare. Let's not just go to the takeaway.
No, exactly. So it was kind of, again, and I looked at all these avenues again, it was how I was fueling myself as well at the time. So I felt as if I was cooking things fresh from scratch with good produce, Again, trying to keep it local and bits in there as well. Enjoying that crafting process that I found quite mindful as well. That was quite an escaping. Cooking, I find very sort of escaping. Just cooking by myself, and I cook the same as I would for somebody else. I would for me. I don't skimp or not present things. I like to do, why not, for yourself. And I felt very much that how I fueled myself was important too. I mean, if I was eating all that crap food and drinking away and smoking, then I was never going to be able to do these things. So it was a bit like putting bad fuel into a car and expecting it to go 100 miles. So I was looking at that point too, not to a nutritionist level. I mean, I'm not sort of tracking your macros and things. Probably still not now, really. I mean, it's probably clear to see. But it's at that point there, it was very much a channel. So I set up this account online at the time. I'd never had an Instagram account before in my life. I barely put anything on social media. The odd selfie of a pint glass when I missed the train on my way back to Cumbria, that was about it. And a bit like the start when I was wearing those masks, I didn't want to reveal who I was. So I tried to come up with a pseudonym. And at the time I was thinking, well, I'm enjoying the fells. I mean, we call the hills in that area, the mountains, fells. I was proud to be from that area. So it sort of fit that sort of line. And I was loving my food. So I thought, Fell Foodie, it's got a nice little ring, a bit of alliteration. We'll go with that. So Fell Food, I started this account, and initially it was just to put pictures of my dinner that I was cooking at home on, not to be one of those annoying people on Facebook, you know. So I didn't want to be known, like, oh, what's he doing now? Show him what he's cooked, who's bothered? And then I was showing the views I was experiencing in the hills. And then that sort of transitioned into me making sort of packed lunches, quite extravagant packed lunches, to take out with me into the mountains to enjoy on the summits whilst I was sat there again, quite mindful, sort of, you know, enjoying that endorphine hit, taking in the views and embracing maybe the sense of achievement. And people would pass some comments, so maybe some peers I'd gone with or people on the hilltop about what I was eating on the top, and going, you know, they got the soggy cling film sandwiches out of the bag and there's me enjoying a nice sort of Tuscan bean stew or a risotto I'd made and all these elements. And one guy said, you know, you should get a stove and actually start cooking out here from scratch. That's just been a bit of a smart aleck, really. I thought, you know what, I can do that. And again, I had no equipment at all. So I bought a stove and I literally packed up what I had in my kitchen. So I was taking ceramic plates, I was taking sort of cast iron pans, I was pestle and mortar at one point, and walking up these hills and now trying to see if I could recreate what I was doing at home, now back in the mountains. And I just love the fact I was merging those two passions, those two outlets together. The practicality wasn't there, you know, there's an element of satire to this to some degree, but enjoyed the fact that there was a challenge aspect to carting the stuff up there. It was a difficult environment to try and recreate these bits, but then I was merging these two very mindful practices that were bringing me joy, and I was having a nice deal at the end as well. And I began posting these online, which gained a bit of traction. And then it got to around my second year sober, so June 6, 2018, and I decided at this point, I was still anonymous at this point in this account, it had grown a little bit, that I was going to reveal who I was. Now, a few friends had sort of followed this account, you know, probably because it pops up, doesn't it, saying, you know, you've got this number saved, you know, phone, do you know who this is? But no one really said anything. And I decided to share in the entirety what I'd gone through, what I now know to be depression, diagnosed clinical depression, from that early age into sort of the subsequent alcoholism, the breakdown, the cheating on the partner, the whole thing completely raw and honest in its full form online. And just like the first time, the support that I got back, the tales of similarity, people with similar aspects and journeys or partners or loved ones that had gone through it, who'd also maybe discovered the outdoors or had had battles or perhaps not even won their battles, came pouring in. And it was so humbling, so empowering, and just felt freeing as well, just revealing this for the first time now to strangers,
like,
really,
a weight
publicly.
Lifted.
For sure. Like, there was a time in this period where about 3 months into the sobriety, it really felt like something really changed in my head. Like those headaches started to go, the sweats went, and it was almost like one day, like you had a big bubble in your head that was a balloon, it was blowing up, so it was really pushing against your cranium, so pushing out. And about literally 3 months in, someone just got a pin and popped that balloon. And again, like revealing this sort of thing at the time, felt again a bit like that, just taking that heavy rucksack off, just, I'm me now. And it led on to some opportunities. I mean, again, some guy wanted to sort of share this on a little local media platform. A guy from local news who ironically had served in the pub at 18, worked for the local news station, said, can we do an interview on the television? And I was now speaking openly about this story, my inner battles, my inner secrets that I wouldn't have told myself in the mirror, now to these major platforms. And it was just beginning to build. And I think for the first time, I was beginning to sort of get a bit of a sense of purpose as well. I think using this sort of story, not for sort of self-gain, but kind of as a way to make those struggles more worthwhile and the fact he could help somebody else, and seeing that kid who was back there in the assembly at school, not knowing what he was going through, staring at the walls, and you were providing that moment of similarity, that you're not alone in this, was something that really, really endeared me.
Yeah, I can see the passion behind that. And quite often, when I think when it comes to content creation or even just the values you live by, try and be the person that you needed can be quite a useful framework from that perspective. And I think you're doing that very, very well. But yeah, I just love that you're now pursuing things that you care about. And it's funny that the food element comes back in, as we were talking about at the start, to now be something that you're pursuing. But the Fells was just completely new to the fact that you were almost ignorant to like what mountains were which and which ones you were going to go up. But now you're obviously just so inside that community.
Yeah, well versed. I mean, they all sounded like craft beer names to me at the time. I didn't really know what they were at all. I mean, I didn't mind my geography at school, but I couldn't really, other than the highest ones, I didn't know what they were. But it was, it was now becoming something. It was now another one to channel. It was now going through maybe the list, looking at sort of particular classifications. In the Lake District, we've got the Wainwright Fells, 214, trying to maybe tick those off. You know, and again, the Munros in Scotland, various bits around the country. And it was that sort of sense of channeling different places, cooking different things on the hills, going out with different people and just different experiences that was also so fulfilling for me physically and mentally, because it was benefiting me, activity outdoors. I mean, it's so simple looking at it now, but it's like, well, okay, I cut out these sort of unhealthy vices. I go into this. No, it's not as easy as, it's not as blunt like that. I mean, sometimes it's easy to sort of maybe make that distinction, but this was going to add to maybe a more fulfilling life for myself and perhaps going to aid maybe these afflictions that I live with. And yeah, it's just very much become a full lifestyle. The Fell foodie bit now. I'm often found cooking on these mountaintops on a little camp stove, preparing these sort of restaurant style meals on the Fell tops and gained a bit of notoriety for it. And again, as well about speaking on my personal journey. So it
goes hand in hand. It really does. Because while you could have probably gained fans and followers and people really engage with your stuff through the food element, the personal element is massive too, because people are looking to understand, who is this? What's their story? Why do they do the things they do? Because it is an unusual thing to do. But when you add up everything that you've been through and the outlets that you're now seeking to channel yourself into, it makes an awful lot more sense. And it also makes more sense that it's a really wholesome thing to do, and it's not causing anyone any challenges. In fact, it's bringing other people joy or interest or entertainment.
It just feels like me being out there as well. And it feels so almost human in a way as well. I mean, I didn't really identify with it at the time, but I mean, I touched upon earlier, again, that food bringing people together, those communities, the primal aspects of maybe gathering around sort of the campfire in a community of sharing. And, you know, we began to sort of do fire, we began to cook outdoors, that became more refined over the years into sort of, I suppose, underground ovens and clay ovens to kitchens today. And now this globalized culture, I guess, of ingredients and recipes, but taking those back out into their root of the outdoors now and going full circle and now having the proverbial campfire in the camp stove. And I'm always, you know, trying to leave no trace out there. I'm always respecting the environment. I'm never lighting fires in national parks. I'm using sort of controlled camp stoves, usually gas, risen up from the ground. There are no scorch marks and bits. So, but out there in that primal setting almost, like you're channeling into those yesteryears. And I think that's still something that's very much, very much in us. And it just feels like the place I'm meant to be, and that other people are meant to be too when they experience it.
Yeah, it means you're acting in alignment. And I think there's a lot to be said for going back to our roots. Is there anything else that you do that's kind of taking you back to your roots outside of the outdoor walks and the cooking away from that? Do you try and... I think there's a lot to be said for ancestral wisdom sometimes.
I think a few, but I think there's certain traits that sort of pop in sometimes that you think that you can definitely align with. I think we were talking about this earlier, weren't we, about sometimes you see it in society as well, sometimes how certain mannerisms and behaviours are quite... on brand for that sort of behavior. But for me, it was just, I guess, that time outdoors, activity, sort of being out there again, community, trying to sort of maybe not sort of the hunting, I mean, the only hunter gathering I sort of do, I suppose, is the yellow labels in the supermarket. But it's kind of enjoying that sort of what's going on, or maybe understanding your environment as well, and how to behave in these different environments, I think I quite embrace. But yeah, I mean, this time, I guess it was just ingrained in me. I think there's definitely the sort of the activity side, but was huge. I mean, the fitness, I was gymming a lot of the time as well, bits in this phase that was going alongside my sort of hill walking and the cooking. So it was very much just an active lifestyle for this stint. But of course, this all began to change really when we got sort of shut down and got locked down in sort of in the pandemic, which was the first time really the closest I'd been to back in those four walls in my own head.
That's a speed bump again, isn't it? It's a potential break point in all these healthy habits when you're asked to spend more time indoors, not doing the things that you've been using. And I don't want to say as coping mechanisms, but as outlets for your healthy expression of the true or the authentic or the happy Harrison. But to see that change again and block, that must have been a challenge. How did you overcome that?
I don't think I did very well, to be honest. I think it was something that I felt quite, again, back to that initial feeling of maybe feeling guilty or feeling that, you know, I can't show a weakness sort of thing here, and still battling with those elements of masks and stuff sometimes. But it felt as if I was in quite a comfortable environment at this point. I was in the Lake District, so a lot of green space. I was very lucky in this setting. So what did I have to complain about? You know, I wasn't stuck in a high-rise building in a city centre and bits. But I was working throughout the pandemic. E-commerce, of course, went absolutely bananas. I mean, the place I was working at the time sells basically baked goods, gingerbread it's famous for. And it seemed that everyone in the world wanted toilet paper and gingerbread during the pandemic. I mean, who knew? But it went absolutely bananas. So my day job went from being, you know, generally quite okay and quite structured to working all hours of the week and 7 days a week. Because again, that knowledge of computers wasn't really in the business elsewhere. So all of a sudden that was all online. It was all on me sort of thing. So, and really it was such a strange phase. You felt as if you were working to sort of protect people's jobs. You were like, I mean, we were classed as key workers, but we were kind of like, well, we're just gingerbread peddlers. Like, I mean, that's not really a key worker. We're not like nurses. We're not the sort of the delivery drivers and things. But that was kind of a new routine there, where now I was doing sort of 14, 16 hour days sometimes in this place. Crazy. But also losing the outlet I had before. So the gym's obviously shut. Wasn't going to those anymore. I couldn't get into this home workout lifestyle because to me it was always a bit like the pub. It was going to a different location. That's the activity I do somewhere else. The hills were there and I'm staring out my bedroom window to like Wandsfell and Loughrigg. But the mountain rescuer then saying, don't go in the hills, because even if you experience and you slip, accidents can happen, and I completely agree with that. You may be then exposing someone from the mountain rescue team if they come out and get you. So, and then maybe there was a slightly increased profile locally, and you're like, I don't want to be one who's going out there and being seen to do it.
Yeah.
And also this strange getting shopped by your neighbours almost. It must have felt borderline xenophobic at one point. Like I was going out of the house and you had the curtains would be twitching and everyone was going, you've got 1 hour outside, which was never law.
Fear is a hell of a motivator for people to behave in very unusual ways indeed. And as it will come, and there's an inquiry at the moment into how the C19 period was handled, our government actually used fear to try and increase compliance, which is I'm pretty uncomfortable with. But in terms of what that meant for you from a mental health perspective and a clarity and an alignment perspective, I can completely see when those things are taken away, it's really difficult. And I think it was a very difficult period for many people in terms of their outlets, and God forbid it happens or we allow it to happen again, so to speak. But coming off the back end of that, you've gone full time into the Fell Foodie, which is super exciting.
It has coming out that, yeah, I think it's just trying to, I mean, the routine was probably still smashed apart at that time and trying to rebuild from that moment. But it was literally a case of a different phase in life. Again, it was very much the period that, you know, I felt as if I could go back to the drink at that point. That would be the escapism. That would allow the days to pass quicker to drink. So the temptation was at its highest at that time. Which thankfully I'm proud to say I didn't fall back on that. But I certainly fell back on food. Now food is both a passion sometimes, but also can be a bit of a crux as well. Maybe the moderation of it, enjoying good food, eating too much, perhaps comfort eating during that phase, when really I wasn't being allowed to maybe have my other outlets that were serving me well. So they were stripped away in a way. So again, as you say, there was many people in the same boat. Many people began drinking more. Many people began eating more. It was just such an uncertain period, but it kind of, those routines I put in place, those structures, I've still been struggling to rebuild those since, because I think during that time, the job was great, really moved on. But then coming out of lockdown, my other stuff started going really well as well. It was a new world. It was kind of like, we went back to marketing, back to this. We want speakers. And I've been working more as a public speaker now at festivals and universities, schools, corporates, as well as sort of the cooking aspect in the outdoors and maybe some brand bits and social media based elements. And that all went bananas. So now I've got this job that's doing really, really, really well. I'm taking a lot of my sort of mind power. And this other outlet now that was now making some money, and it was becoming more than a side hustle. And I had to make the decision. So I was kind of like, well, either I stick with the job that's been very good to me, and it's been great, and I very enjoy being there and enjoy the colleagues and the employers I had there, or I back myself. And I decided, well, let's try and back myself. Let's give this a go. So these days, I mean, I'm kind of just, we talked about this earlier about how you define yourself. I'm just kind of me really as this sort of self-employed, you know, outdoor cook, which is just, how do you make any money doing that? But it's kind of all grown from that period. And again, maybe being enhanced and thrown out that slingshot, the other side of lockdown. But perhaps maybe coming at a point where I was probably close to burnout, to be honest, in that period. Then all of a sudden jumping out and trying to start your own business. So I think it took probably a good year. I mean, I'm 18 months in now, but a year of that, of actually then realizing the fact that, well, I've not reestablished those previous structures. You know, I hadn't gone back to the gym at that point. I was maybe just traveling about a lot more. So I was eating pretty crap food from the service stations. I was talking about the outdoors a lot, but I was often down in, you know, the NEC in Birmingham, or I was down in London in corporates talking about the outdoors.
I need to keep practicing the things that I know work for me, but I'm not preaching, but I'm also sharing with others.
The balance for sure. But it's led into some fantastic opportunities too. I mean, again, still having that story at the root of it. I mean, I've just passed 7 years, 7 years sober now.
I messaged you after that. I'm delighted to see that. And I think that's inspiring for a lot of people as well.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. It does get easier over time, but there's still moments of not being complacent to these things. But 7 years, again, and sometimes it feels like yesterday. Sometimes it feels like 70 years. You know, it's a very, very different lifestyle and structure, but that same person ultimately in there. But the opportunity since to be able to share this story, you know, further and go around and talk to some fantastic people and be there. And the similarities, again, it's always about the fact that there's always someone there on the other side. I never like to call myself in this sort of motivational speaker sort of avenue now. And that's kind of the job title, the ultimate element of what I do. But it's not my place to say that. You know, I'm not to say, oh, I'm going to motivate you. I'm going to inspire you. I'm just telling you what I've been through. I'm not a medical professional. I've just lived experience. And if you get something from that, that's fantastic. But there'll always be someone in that room. If it's not there themselves, it'll be a loved one, a colleague, a partner that has gone through these same afflictions, because we really aren't alone on this. And that's been the main thing for me, reaching out, talking, and just confiding in others. I think it's been a huge help. Seeking medical help as well, looking at those avenues available, because for so long I suffered in silence. And it was really something that I nearly didn't come out the other side of.
Yeah, it is really powerful. And I love the fact that, and we got connected through Fergus largely, didn't we? Who is a brilliant speaker on men's mental health as well, or mental health in general. And it is all about that verbalization. But look at the massive action you took to radically change the character, that destruction of the previous self. And so no wonder you feel so much better. You feel so much more in alignment. And I think if anyone can take anything from that kind of element of your story, it's you rebuilt in areas that you can see yourself getting fulfillment from. Not everyone's going to end up cooking some of the extravagant dishes you do on the side of a mountain, but think about the things that you can maybe do to get back in touch with things that you truly care about, that you truly enjoy, that makes you feel great, and give yourself the opportunity to chase that. And while I also think it's amazing to note as well, you ended up doing really well in a job because you were healthier and more aligned and more switched on. And that job wasn't necessarily your passion. Your passion isn't e-commerce, but you put yourself in a position where you were healthy and well, and you were able to excel in your career on the side, which is quite an exciting prospect for anyone listening to this that maybe doesn't have entrepreneurial tendencies.
There was guidelines and things to achieve, wasn't there? And there was goals almost to work towards, where a letter on a bit of paper never really seemed to be much of a goal for me. But seeing maybe the figures or the progression or the growth and hearing stories back, that was in the job side of things, of moments of, you know, receiving the product or bits and successful deliveries or attempts in business was quite tangible and something I definitely did latch on to. But likewise in my own stuff now, I think it's that seeing the progression in my personal life and those around me, perhaps, you know, opening up these conversations that maybe keeps it going as well, as something to embrace.
No doubt about it. And I'm sure the audience will be embracing that, Harrison. If they would like to continue the conversation with you, where should they head towards?
So you can find me on most of the social media platforms these days. I go by Fell Foodie on there, and more than happy to receive any bits there, any questions about stuff I've spoke about too, always very receivable. I mean, not medical professional, but more than happy to share lived experiences on there. But thank you for your time.
Amazing, Harrison. The Instagram will be linked in the show notes, and if you're looking anywhere else for Harrison, you can make sure you find them, and I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very soon.